just recently in the last 3 or 4 years, the numbers have gone up. And they're flying profiles that they haven't flown before.
The commander of NORAD talks about the increase of Russian flights near Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, February 25th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Tlingit Haida Council authorizes its courts to perform gay marriages.
If showing that we care about all of our tribal citizens equally can send a message, you know, where they feel inclusive and belong and loved, then that's what we should do.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The F-35 aircraft, the new fighter the Air Force wants to keep at Eielson Air Force Base, has been plagued by cost overruns and equipment failures. But Air Force brass told a U.S. Senate committee this morning those problems are in the past. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
In recent years, many have called on the Pentagon to pull the plug on the expensive aircraft. But Air Force Chief of Staff General Mark Welsh says the F-35 is back on track.
This is no longer a PowerPoint slide. We have flown thousands of F-35 sorties now. They're on the ramps in multiple bases. We are starting training of our first operational pilots. And so we are well into this program being a real thing. A year from now, a year and a half from now, we will declare initial operational capability for the F-35, and I see nothing that stands in the way.
Secretary of the Air Force Deborah Lee James says she also believes the F-35 will make upcoming deadlines despite uncertainties.
Software can be a tricky matter, and that always is a bit of a concern, and then we've had the need for experienced maintenance people to be able to shift over to the F-35. We think we've got that reasonably under control now.
And James says if budget sequestration continues, the Air Force would have to buy fewer F-35s, which would drive up the cost of each aircraft, now estimated at $115 million apiece. The F-35 is designed to be stealthier and detect enemy aircraft faster. A version designed for the Marines can hover and land like a helicopter. Stumbles in the development have included $1,500 tires that didn't hold up and wingtip lights that didn't meet FAA standards. Eielson is the Air Force's preferred location for the first F-35 squadrons. The final basing decision is expected in 2016. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Admiral Bill Gortney visited Alaska for the first time earlier this month since taking over the two organizations tasked with defending North America from attack. Gortney wears two hats. He's head of both the North American Aerospace Defense Command, or NORAD, as well as the U.S. Northern Command. It's one of the highest positions in the military chain of command, responsible for dealing with airborne threats, whether that's missiles launched from a hostile country or a rogue plane within American airspace. After a visit to Fort Wainwright and the missile fields in the interior, Gortney came to Anchorage for an inspection of Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. He told KSKA's Zachariah Hughes the strategic importance of Alaska can't be overstated.
The world is round. Most people don't realize that. The world is round, and your location allows us to get from here to defend from the northern approaches as well as deploy from here. You know, it's just the F-22s that are stationed here can get to England or to the Middle East quicker than they can from the continental United States there down south. So it's an incredibly important strategic asset. As far as recently, the importance of what we do out of this great state, and oh, by the way, the pictures don't do it justice, is the increased activity of Russian long-range aviation, the Bear bombers. And so they are, we believe, messaging using these long-range aviation flights. And so very frequently when they do come down here, we launch assets, aircraft, fighters, tankers, and airborne early warning here from Alaska, as well as Canada does the same thing. We coordinate that activity, whichever one makes the most sense.
You said messaging. What does that mean?
Well, all countries use their military in a messaging way, you know, to display strength should they need to. That's what we mean by messaging. It's not in a kinetic sense. It's not in a hostile. It's just that we're here. We can do these sorts of things.
The Russian long-range craft that have been entering airspace, how frequently is that occurring, and when did it start?
Well, they've been doing it since they were the Soviet Union. They took a pause for I'm not sure how many years, but just recently in the last 3 or 4 years, the numbers have gone up. I'm not going to give you the percentage because the percentage implies, you know, if I said 500%, you might get that's a whole lot, but, you know, if I think that's five is 500% of one, right? But it has gone up significantly that we've noticed here. And they're flying profiles that they haven't flown before. Now, they've never entered our territorial airspace, which goes out to 12 nautical miles. But they have entered our, what we call our air defense identification zone. And all nations have these that go pretty far out there. And they're adhering to the international standards that they're supposed to do, that they're out there. The numbers have gone up, but they fly it in a professional manner, just as we fly in a professional manner.
Switching gears just for a second, the U.S. is poised to take over some new Arctic responsibilities. And is the importance of the Arctic changing, and the way that capabilities and assets are deployed, are those changing?
Yes, actually, one of my assigned missions from the Secretary of Defense is to be the advocate for the Arctic for the Department of Defense. And we really, since this is the Arctic, a little bit further north if you draw the line correctly, we use our the Army and the Air Force and also Coast Guard and a little bit of Navy out of here to help us do that advocacy role in the Arctic. Absolutely critical. You know, this is a pretty harsh place to live and operate. It takes a particular skill set, equipment, and people to really know how to operate. And this gives us that opportunity to understand that.
With the national drawdown in the armed forces going on and sequestration kind of looming large over a lot of those conversations, how's your work going to change going forward? And is there any change in the resources you have at your disposal?
Well, coming out of every major war, there's a 27 to 32% reduction in the Department of Defense budget. This goes all the way back to the Revolutionary War, and of course we didn't have a DOD back then. But so this isn't the first time we're coming out of major war and the budget goes down. And so it's a reality, we have to deal with it. How we do that as a nation is the hard part. The other piece is that every other time we've come out of major war, we go into an international security environment better than the one we went in. You would think that's why you went to war. And in the last 3 years, if you look at the international security environment around the world, it is not a more secure environment than we went in. And it's nobody's fault. It's just we didn't predict it. No one predicted what's occurred. And so that is what's different this time. And so that causes me concern.
And do you still get to fly?
No, I don't. I'm too old.
Do you miss it?
I do. Yeah, I do. But, you know, I had a pretty good run, and now it's up for the young pups to do it.
Admiral Bill Gortney is the head of NORAD and NORTHCOM, two parts of the military charged with defending the North American continent. The Coast Guard is holding a cargo ship in Unalaska over alleged environmental crimes. The Lendavia arrived in port from China a couple of weeks ago. Kevin Feldis with the U.S. Attorney's Office says the 600-foot ship was loading up with seafood to take back to Asia, but was detained before it could leave port.
Right now, the crew is still here in Dutch Harbor, and they will be staying there pending further steps in the investigation.
Feldis is working with the Coast Guard on the case. He couldn't say more about the alleged violations, citing the open investigation. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, lawmakers cut early education programs in the proposed budget.
I looked at our Constitution, and I looked what we're constitutionally mandated to do.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Doyon Limited announcing the 2015 Board of Directors election, encouraging e-proxy or paper proxy submission no later than Tuesday, March 10th before 5 p.m. Information at doyon.com.
ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, gives Alaska Native students the inspiration and opportunity to excel in science and engineering careers, building a sustainable future for Alaska. More at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
Attorneys for both sides wrapped up arguments today in a case that could reverse state prohibitions against some Medicaid-funded abortions. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, attorneys for Planned Parenthood claim a state statute is too restrictive and violates a woman's constitutional rights.
Alaska Superior Court Judge John Suttuck heard closing arguments today in a case that is likely headed to the state's Supreme Court. After 7 days of testimony from expert witnesses, Suttuck's charge is now to decide if the state's list of physical ailments that qualify a woman for a, quote, medically necessary abortion, an abortion that would be funded by Medicaid, is in line with an earlier Alaska Supreme Court ruling that requires Medicaid reimbursement only in the case of medically necessary, not elective, abortions. Arguing for the plaintiffs, Planned Parenthood of the Great Northwest attorney Autumn Katz said that the statute violates constitutional equal protection and privacy rights of low-income women. Katz says the statute makes it all but impossible for them to get Medicaid-funded abortions.
The funding restrictions exclude many physical and virtually all mental health conditions in direct contravention of the 2001 decision.
Plaintiffs allege the current definition of medically necessary excludes mental health and socioeconomic issues that could influence a woman's decision to terminate a pregnancy. Suttuck asked Katz if she could write the statute, would all abortions be funded as they are in some other states, or could the state constitutionally draw a line?
Where are you coming from?
Right. And I think where we're coming from is that if the state wants to draw a line, any appropriate line has to leave the physicians with the discretion to make those determinations based on an individual's risk factors and the circumstances of their lives.
But state attorney Margaret Payton Walsh says the state has already drawn a line, and that line is the 2014 legislation that delineates more than 20 physical conditions that, according to the statute, would allow a Medicaid-funded abortion. Peyton Walsh says Planned Parenthood does not make a reasonable distinction between medically necessary and elective abortions.
The Supreme Court expressly anticipated that the legislature would be in a position to define medical necessity and to limit the state's obligation to pay for elective abortions.
Suttuck says the case must prove that the state statute is not driven by a prejudice against abortion. He thanked the attorneys and witnesses and looked to the next step.
Good Lord, you've given me a headache. What am I going to do? Whatever it is, I'll do my best. And as we all know, I'm a speed bump on the way to the Supreme Court.
There is no word yet on when a Superior Court decision is expected. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
2 days after Governor Bill Walker filed a bill to create a marijuana control board, and a day after the drug became legal in the state, state senators are offering legislation setting terms for that board. The 25-page bill was offered by the Senate Judiciary Committee today. It would require marijuana retailers and growers to be licensed by the state instead of just getting business registrations. They would have to be an Alaska resident for at least 1 year before they can apply and would need to go through fingerprinting and background checks. The legislation also addresses the packaging and advertising of marijuana products. It requires retailers to keep the drug in child-safe containers and limits them from marketing marijuana in a way that would be enticing to minors, but without defining what that means. It also requires edible marijuana products to be sold in serving sizes that have a maximum of 10 milligrams of THC, the active chemical in marijuana. Lawmakers are targeting a number of early education programs for cuts. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports.
Pre-kindergarten grants, parents as teachers, best beginnings, all of these early learning programs were zeroed out in the budget recommendations offered by a House Education Subcommittee on Tuesday night.
I looked at our Constitution, and I looked what we're constitutionally mandated to do.
Representative Lynn Gaddis, a Wasilla Republican, chairs the subcommittee. She says with the state facing a multi-billion dollar budget deficit, her prerogative was to make cuts to newer programs, programs that had not been fully funded in the past, and programs that did not meet the standard of essential. More than $12 million was cut from the Department of Education's budget. But the base student allocation, that is, the funding that's divvied out to schools based on their enrollment numbers, was not touched.
My goal was to keep the classrooms whole. So in order to do that, let's not reach into the BSA. Let's not go there. So what are your choices to make your numbers?
On top of cuts to early education, the subcommittee eliminated funding for a literacy program and a library technology program. They also slashed $5 million meant to expand broadband internet access to the state schools. The cuts are perennially controversial. Early education programs in particular have been a traditional political football. Conservative Republicans have targeted them for cuts, arguing that they compete with private sector daycare and may duplicate federal education programs. Democrats have sought to expand pre-kindergarten learning programs, especially for low-income children. Representative Sam Keto III, a Juneau Democrat, opposed the early education cuts on Tuesday night.
I'm concerned that if we take funding away from our younger kids, that we're actually going to see a decrease in graduation rates in the future.
Keto also has concerns with how the cuts were advanced. While Keto expressed opposition to some cuts during the subcommittee hearing, he was not allowed to offer any amendments to the proposal during that meeting.
Denying the amendments denies our ability to comment and to hear from the department. So we have less of an ability to make our voices heard.
The process bothered Keto enough that he stood up in the House chambers on Wednesday to raise complaints before the whole body. After the House floor session, Gaddis defended her approach. She noted that Keto's colleagues in the House Democratic minority will have the ability to fight the cuts later. The education recommendations will now be sent to the House Finance Committee. In better budget years, some funding for early education programs has been restored at that stage. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The legislature is considering cutting in half the amount of funding available for public broadcasting. Representative Lynn Gaddis, a Wasilla Republican who chairs the Department of Administration Finance Subcommittee, introduced the cuts by saying the group was focused on essential needs.
In this fiscal climate, the state should focus on mission-critical services, reduce its footprint, and take this opportunity to get out of business that it doesn't need to be in. This has been an opportunity to truly evaluate the wants versus the needs of state government.
Between operations and infrastructure, public radio and television were granted $5 million in state funds in the last budget. With the proposal offered by the House Finance Subcommittee, funding would be reduced to $2.5 million. Tyson Gallagher, an aide for Gaddis, explained that the cuts would be focused on outlets that have other broadcasting options in their service area. That includes commercial radio stations.
With the advancements in technology and development of other broadcast sources, there's less of a need to maintain public service programming at comparable levels to prior years.
Last year, state grants contributed more than $500,000 to Alaska Public Media's $6 million budget, which includes the South Central station KSKA. KTOO, the Juneau public radio station, now gets 10% of its $2 million budget from state grants. The changes will now be sent to the full House Finance Committee for consideration.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on Condor.com. Condor, born to fly. If you're 50 or over, this message is for you. Preventing colon cancer or finding it early doesn't have to be expensive. Most insurance plans and Medicare help pay for screening, and there are simple, affordable tests available that can be done in the privacy of your own home. Talk with your doctor about colon screening today.
More at alaskacolonhealth.org. This message sponsored by Ride for Life.
A Barrow State representative was taken by ambulance from the state capitol today. House Speaker Mike Chenault said Representative Benjamin Nagiak, a Democrat from Barrow, wasn't feeling well, and given his medical history, it was thought better to have Nagiak checked by medical personnel than to do nothing. Nagiak underwent a heart procedure in 2013 after doctors found blockages. He is now under observation at a hospital. The Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission is defending itself against a recent state report pointing out inefficiencies and legislation that could dissolve the agency. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission Chair Bruce Twomley is worried about the agency's future, especially after a bill was introduced last week to dismantle the commission as a cost-saving measure.
We would like to get to the end of this session so that we can do what we can do on our end to try to suggest savings. We hope we're still in a position to do that. We hope we're still intact at the end of this session.
The Department of Fish and Game released a report earlier this month that draws attention to backlogged permit application cases, a slow work pace by commission heads, and alternatives to the agency's organizational structure. The commission responded Monday to the report in writing and posted it on its website. The commission doesn't take issue with the whole report. Twomley recognizes it includes a lot of praise for the agency, and he stands firmly behind one of the report's recommendations to maintain the three commissioners until all the cases are complete.
We think that is a very sound recommendation.
Since its creation in 1973, Twomley says the commission has been going through a deluge of thousands of applications to limited entry fisheries and is now down to the last 28 cases. The report recommends the remaining cases be complete by the end of June. A more reasonable time frame, says Twomley, is by the end of 2016. He defends why the commission takes so long to adjudicate cases.
Some cases are more than 15 years old because we had more than 23,000 applications to work through. And the reason is really the volume and the complexity of the cases and the fact that these huge caseloads arrive almost at the same time.
A bill by Representative Louise Stutes would eliminate the commission by transferring duties to Fish and Game and a division of the Department of Administration. Twomley says the survival of the agency is vital. He says the commission will likely limit one or more fisheries in the near future, but wouldn't name them. He says the work the commission does is complicated and specialized. Twomley has been a CFEC commissioner since Governor Jay Hammond appointed him in 1982.
Only reason I'm sticking around is because I think there is some critical work to be done. But if someone wants to force my retirement, that would not be the worst thing that could happen to me. It would not be good, however, I think, for the agency or the task and the remaining employees at the agency.
The CFEC has 28 full-time employees, including the three commissioners. The House Fisheries Committee on Tuesday heard an agency overview from the CFEC commissioners. Committee Chair Stutes said the Fish and Game report wouldn't be discussed, but committee members alluded to details in the report through their questions, like the slow pace of adjudication. Stutes says her bill to eliminate the CFEC will get its first hearing March 5th. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Southeast Alaska's largest tribal organization has authorized its courts to perform same-sex marriages. The Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska announced its new policy Monday. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Tlingit Haida's seven-member governing board voted February 20th to define legal marriage without a gender requirement. President Richard Peterson says the council is exercising its governing authority to include all tribal members.
It's something that we can do to extend our sovereignty for all of our tribal citizenry. It's not just about the same-sex marriage and helping just one segment of our tribal citizens, but all of our tribal citizens.
Peterson says, as far as he knows, Tlingit Haida's courts have not conducted marriages in the past. He wants the new policy to encourage same and opposite sex marriages. The tribal government will issue marriage licenses, but it's unclear whether they'll be recognized by the state. Court rulings forced Alaska to allow same-sex marriages, but many top officials remain opposed.
It's certainly not to do it despite them or anything like that. I'm very hopeful that they're going to recognize these marriages, because the folks that we're going to be marrying are Alaskans.
Tlingit Haida will require at least one person in a couple to be a tribal member. The council lists nearly 30,000 Tlingit and Haida Indians in and outside Alaska within its rolls. Peterson cites high suicide rates among Alaska Natives, as well as gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender youths, as another reason for the policy.
If showing that we care about all of our tribal citizens equally can send a message, you know, where they feel inclusive and belong and loved, and if that helps them not want to turn to suicide and other things because they feel forsaken, then that's what we should do.
Peterson says the council knows of about 20 other tribes amending or adopting rules to recognize gender equality. Some others determined no changes were needed to allow same-sex unions. He says that's a small percentage of the 560 or so federally recognized tribes in the United States.
Well, we just recently had Elizabeth Pradovich Day, and, you know, she so eloquently spoke at a time when we were still referred to as savages and we didn't have the rights to vote. So now here we are and we still have tribal citizens that don't have rights, and I think we need to provide for that and advocate for that.
What the tribal authorities are doing here is moving in the very same direction that the country is moving.
Evan Wilson is founder and president of Freedom to Marry, a nationwide advocacy organization based in New York City. The group lists tribal governments in the Pacific Northwest, the Upper Midwest, and Oklahoma, where same-sex marriages were approved during the past half dozen years.
Members of the tribes know what it's like to experience discrimination. They know what it's like to be shoved outside, to be looked down on. And I think what tribal authorities are saying is that out of that history, we know it's important that we not commit the same kinds of discrimination, that we not isolate people, that we not harm them.
Tlingit Haida Central Council's new marriage directive also includes tribal divorces. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting in Juneau.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Annie Ropeek in Onalaska, and Lisa Fu and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. The 2015 PFD filing season is here. If you have questions about your absences or someone you know away at college or serving in the military, the State of Alaska Department of Revenue encourages you to be proactive. Check out the absence guidelines before applying for your PFD. Visit pfd.alaska.gov and click on eligibility in the banner to learn more. The deadline to apply is March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.